Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
With the man on the moon, loving strings.
For those of you guys who are just tuning in, peek behind the curtain. Our producer is imitating the voice of our voice of God. Ooh, now we're hearing far more than I think. Very loud. Ileana, I think this experience is a microcosm of what it's like to live through Corona. Just a bit of confusion, yeah. Trying to sort everything out.
That was Sparhusen there, yes. A little snippet of that. Hello, Jeff. How's it going?
It's going. We're getting through things. Of course, you guys are tuned into the film scene, Ileana's podcast. We missed last week, but we're back. We don't have a guest this week, but we will be getting more guests continually. We just wanted to check in with you guys and let you know that we're doing okay. Ileana, it's been a tough week for you, though.
Oh, my God. And I just want to say I know because people are on Twitter, I'm getting everybody's questions here, and we are going to get to the questions, which I'm very excited about, and I'll answer them all. But it was very strange. I think this whole coronavirus thing is going to be peaks and valleys for everybody, because yesterday for me was actually my best day so far. I got up, one of my dance teachers started doing online, so I did the online class. A neighbor, because I can't stand in the 45 minute supermarket lines, a neighbor went and got me fresh salmon. I was in tears. I just thought it was such a kind thing to do. I went on a bike ride and I thought, yeah, I can handle this. And then I came home and I found out, you know, that Adam Schlesinger I died, and I think I sat in the chair and just stared for 2 hours, just
yeah.
In a state of shock, absolute shock, and the repercussions of this on so many levels, just to the world of entertainment. I think he's a person that, you know, maybe people might know the band Fountains of Wayne, you know, but they don't, he was involved with so many great things. Tom Hanks, That Thing You Do, Cry Baby, the musical on Broadway. Of course, My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which was phenomenal. Stephen Colbert's Christmas Show. Just was an irreplaceable talent. And, you know, there is, in my small little way, there was a project we were talking about maybe working together, and that just the idea that he's gone, I'm just kind of comprehending it in a very small way. But it made me realize that even though I'm, you know, maybe even the first person in my circle to lose someone, that we're all by the end of this going to lose a lot of people, and the repercussions of it are just going to be staggering, you know? And the
I was just going to say, up until last week, it kind of felt like this was a disease that mostly targeted people who had lived really long lives.
Right.
But I feel like all of a sudden people who I assumed to be invincible, like you think of Adam Schlesinger, as someone who just, you know, obviously incredibly famous, talented, wealthy enough to, you know, you'd assume had the resources to fight this. So to hear that people like him, he's only in his early 50s.
Right.
This is real stuff. This is wartime right now, and we're all going to lose people we love.
Yeah, and I was thinking that how sad it was going to be that, you know, in years from now, 10, 20 years from now, and people look him up on Wikipedia, they'll hear a song of his, and they'll read about him, and they'll say, wow, did people actually die of coronavirus? You know, it'll be this strange thing that we won't, you know, that it just, unfortunately, all the people that it hit first aren't going to have the benefit of surviving this thing.
You're so right. Because at some point, it will become probably vaccinated, it will protect against it. But you think of people, famous people who died of the Spanish flu, which now seems like ancient history.
Of course.
We're living through that right now.
Yeah. And then, just on a very small level, this other guy that I worked with early on, Mark Bloom, who was in a movie I did called Search and Destroy many years ago. He went into producing. He was in Desperately Seeking Susan. He was the first person I said, wow, somebody actually worked with. So it's very intense. The other thing that has really hit me just in the world of entertainment, I really don't think early on I sort of felt, well, things are going to change and we'll get kind of back to the way we are. But now I really feel like entertainment's going to change in just a fundamental way. I don't know what that is yet, but I think it's really going to change. One of the things I've noticed, you said you weren't watching the talk shows as much as I have, but you know, there's an intimacy now with everybody doing the show from home where the humor really is no longer forced. It's not like a pre-written joke. It's coming out of a real situation and people's wives are being mentioned and kids are running in and out of the picture. And it kind of reminds me of the early days of live television, you know, when people would come on and they'd talk about their home life because that's where the inherent comedy is. And we've almost kind of gone back to that. But I've become just addicted to watching these shows. Before, if maybe somebody was on, I'd say, oh, I want to take a look at that. But it always had that forced feeling.
Right. Manufactured.
But now, you know, I was watching Ryan Reynolds last night. And he's talking about his dad, and it's very intimate. And I don't know if we can go back to the kind of way it was. I'm sort of curious about that.
Yeah, there's something very human about, there's something so universal that's happening right now that it's forcing everyone to, it's putting everyone on the same level. So even if you're a wealthy talk show host, if you're having to broadcast out of your basement because you're scared for your life, it gives everyone the chance to identify with you. So I tend to be an optimist. I tend to be a positive person. Maybe it's my cloying Ohio Midwesternness, but I'd like to think there's some good that can come out of all this. And if people reevaluate their priorities and kind of learn to really lean into what matters and learn to wash their hands, then hopefully we'll get better as a people when we get through it.
My favorite thing, it continues to go on, is the backgrounds when people are broadcasting from home. And Seth Meyers had a great thing, because I guess the first night he was broadcasting in his garage, and that didn't work out because it was too cold, and now he's up in his attic. I just find it like, it's just, there's an intimacy there that's just really funny, and we're seeing inside people's homes. And I noticed, like, on MSNBC, some of the people, you know, like there's one doctor and he has behind him, there's a coat rack, and in the same exact spot, there's a bike helmet and there's like biking gear, but it never looks like it moves. So I don't know if he wants us to think he's a biker, or in Adam Schiff's office, he's got like an old roll top desk and a photo of Bobby Kennedy. And there's a little, you know, there's a semi-set design. And then some people, you just have like really ugly IKEA furniture and you think, and that person's not interesting at all, you know? So I'm completely obsessed with looking into people's homes. And if anyone has any interest in my home, I would love to do show and tell.
Let's do that. At least if we don't do it this episode, let's do it next episode.
Okay, I want to answer a couple questions here. First of all, I noticed there's a note that you know, a mention of a Marie Windsor, that I look like Marie Windsor. I know it's been a long-standing thing. I love it. I think it's hysterical, and I love Marie Windsor, and I met her, and I occasionally post this picture of me meeting her. The first question is from Brett Sheehan. What was it like to work with Martin Scorsese? And, you know, obviously it was great. One thing that came my way, it's on YouTube. Somebody has posted footage from when we were making Goodfellas, because I wrote about this in my book. We didn't have trailers. We were living in people's houses. You know, we were getting made up, and it was a really carnival-like atmosphere. People were cooking out on the street, and you're getting dressed in someone's house and then going into another house. Well, there's home movies that are on YouTube that someone just posted, and I'm in them, and you can see De Niro and Joe Pesci and Lorraine Bracco. Absolutely incredible. So they're really fun. But as far as we're, you know, working with Marty, I learned so much kind of early on, and you're going to see it in Goodfellas, you know, just a lot of the instinctual things about, you know, leaving the camera on and trusting your instincts and not doing things too big. He has, gets a tremendous respect, obviously, for actors, and, it's hard to encapsulate all the years of being with him and learning about movies, but it was amazing. So
do you feel like in your career you've worked with directors who love and really cherish actors, and then directors who treat actors sort of like their chess pieces as you're making a movie?
Yes, and so for me, I had this interesting experience where, you know, the first people I worked with, you know, Martin Scorsese and Michael Bauhaus as a DP, and Nestor Alamandros, and Robert De Niro, and it was all like very top shelf. And so then when I got thrown out into the world and I was working with some other people, I found it was not as easy of an experience, mm-hmm. because in their world, they were very collaborative, you know. I came from a comedy improv background. And again, what's remarkable to me, and going back to Goodfellas, watching the thing, I'm like, who did I think I was? I'm like, I just went on the set and I'm saying this line and saying that line, you know. As I got older, I got very afraid to do that, mm-hmm. because I was afraid of being yelled at, you know. It was like, what is she saying? She's not supposed to be saying the line on the page. But in Marty's world, you came to it with, how about this idea? How about this? You came to it with 10 ideas, and then he just picked sort of the ones, you know, that he wanted. And then I learned with the hard way with some other directors that when I did that, they were very unhappy. They had a very narrow opinion of what they wanted. And if I deviated from that, it was complicated.
Well, I bet as an actress, the more safe and included you feel on a set, the better your performance is.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I that was kind of what I felt like, you know, in these recent shows that I worked on, Shrill, which got picked up. I'm so excited about that. And also Goliath. Mm-hmm. It just was a very collaborative atmosphere. Yes, we had the script, but, you know, you came to it with a lot of ideas. And again, they picked and choose, like, we like this, we don't like this. For me, I find it very hard when I've done certain shows and I go to get the fitting and the person says, well, the director and I talked and we decided you're wearing this. And I have absolutely no say in it. I find that to be, it goes against all the training that I ever had, mm-hmm. which is try this, try that, try this, try all these different things and then see which one works out the best. Should I answer the next question?
Let's do it.
This is great. This is from, and I recognize you, Pity the Backseat. What was the best thing about working with Matt Dillon, apart from the broken finger? It was a broken thumb. Matt actually accidentally broke my thumb. We were kidding around on the set of To Die For. First of all, when I was a kid, I don't know a girl who was not madly, madly in love with Matt Dillon. And so when I was going to be in To Die For and be his sister, first of all, I couldn't believe it. We spoke on the phone, and then the first time I was going to meet him, we were all going over to Nicole and Tom Cruise's house. That was like our introduction. You know, we're going to all have dinner. And I remember I must have changed like 5 times up in my hotel room. I was like, no, too much. nah, too casual, you know. I was like so nervous. I wanted Matt Dillon to like me. And we just hit it off like gangbusters. Man, did I, just like a brother and sister thing, I adored Matt. And he's so much more complex, I think, than from what I saw in the films. You know, I loved him in movies, but he knows so much about food and art and traveled to Cuba and Vietnam. And he's just like a very, very interesting, nice person. And then I loved working with him. And then I had the privilege, of course, to work with him again in Grace of My Heart. And then he was my husband. And it was very hard to transition from the brother-sister relationship we had. Mm. Suddenly, you know, here it was like my childhood dream, getting to make out with Matt Dillon. And I got very nervous about it. I couldn't believe it. I was like a little schoolgirl. But he's the best. What a kind, he's a really kind, nice person.
I love that. That's great. We got more questions. Let's see what else we have. I can get you on this one. Let's see. Victor Devone says, what was filming The Next Best Thing like, and were you involved in any rewrites?
Well, that's very interesting. I'll tell you about The Next Best Thing. The script of The Next Best Thing, I did a movie many, many years ago with an actor named Craig Chester. It was called Grief. The director was Richard Glatzer. And around that time, I was actually given the script of The Next Best Thing to do it with Craig Chester. And I loved the script. I thought it was amazing. You know, and then, you know, it disappeared. And then many years later, I got to know John Schlesinger. I met him at a film festival and we had dinner and we just kind of hit it off. And it turned out I lived very near him up in the Hollywood Hills. And he asked me to be, and by that point, Madonna and Rupert Everett were going to do The Next Best Thing. And he asked me to be in it, you know, to play this supporting role. And so I mainly did it just, you know, what are you going to do? John Schlesinger asked you to do this movie. And I'm a big believer in, I just love working and meeting people. And I thought it would be kind of fun. So I was in, you know, and we had John Carroll Lynch on the show. He was Madonna's lawyer, and I'd met Madonna when she worked with Alison Anders on this movie called Four Rooms, and Madonna was always extremely nice to me and very respectful, and not as nice to John Carroll. And the same thing with Rupert Everett. He was very nice to me, but it did seem a little bit like it was a runaway train, you know, that I was on the sidelines and just trying to be supportive and talk to John Schlesinger. But yes, a lot of the rewrites were happening and scenes were being added that maybe got really away from the main script. But the one funny talk that I remember having, we did a lot of things I did were courtroom scenes. And Rupert, who I love, was like very dramatic. He would do these scenes. I used to call it Joan Crawford acting. Like he would go to the corner and then dramatically kind of turn around to deliver a line. And John Schlesinger, we were doing the courtroom scene. He said, how do you like working with Rupert? And I said, oh, you mean Madonna and Prima Donna? That's great. So that kind of became the... his nickname. But I'm always, you know, what's so funny is that I felt bad for John Schlesinger because he's made so many amazing films and this was probably not the best way to end his career. And I haven't seen the movie in many, many years, but I've always said it was the best lighting I ever saw in my life. Cause Madonna's lighting, I told you, it was like working on the sun. It was so bright. It was like a white light. And I bobbed my hair speaking of getting into what I wanted the character to look like. So I had a blast.
So, I love that. That's so fun. Now, yeah. Have you worked with Madonna twice?
No, that was the only time. As I said, I met her through that Four Rooms. And as was often the case, you know, with stars sometimes, you know, they would do all of Madonna's coverage and then she would just leave, you know, and we would be acting to a white board, which was fine. But they'd say, okay, Em, you're done for the day. But when it was me, she'd always say, no, I don't mind staying. So it was kind of a strange thing. As I've talked about this all the time, sometimes people isolate a star in a way that it does them a little bit of a disservice. Right. Because then when they try to re-enter the fray, it makes it a little challenging, you know?
Well, you're always someone, I'm sure most of our audience knows, but oftentimes on a set, big stars will have stand-ins. So when the scene is setting up and they're lighting it, they have someone else, you know, stand in so they can get lit, and then they bring talent out to do the scene. You're someone who likes to be on set as much as you can.
Okay, but again, this is so interesting, going back to Marty.
Yeah.
This is totally accidental. The first three movies I did with Marty, I never had a stand in.
Wow.
I kind of didn't really know there was a stand in.
Right.
Because I did everything with kind of De Niro, you know what I mean? With Nick Nolte. We were doing all of it. Now, whether or not that's something that Marty likes, but I kind of enjoyed it because I was sort of able to get rid of some nerves that I had
by,
you know, just going over the lines and practicing it and saying, okay, I'm going to be here and be here. But nowadays, it's very interesting. Nowadays, everybody has a stand-in. And so, yeah, when I come in, they go, okay, I picked up this and I did this. And it makes me a little bit nervous because it always changes a little bit once the real person is in there. To tell you the truth, I don't mind standing in. And again, another movie, you know, I was making a joke about Alive. There was no stand-ins. We were on a mountain, you know, like we did it all ourselves. So you couldn't leave the set. You were on a mountain. So
I love the idea of someone moving to Los Angeles and joining Central Casting to get background work and then finding out their first gig is to fly to the middle of nowhere to be in Alive.
Well, I've learned, we were talking about this at the beginning of the show. This is my picture from, let's see if you can see it.
Hold it up, and I think Ryan can actually zoom in on it if you hold it right there.
Hold it right there. So I took this picture out. It's me and Ethan Hawke from Alive. It's kind of that joke that everybody's doing, you know, me on March 1st, me on April 1st. But I've been thinking about Alive a lot because that was 4 months, and we didn't have phones. You know, cell phones weren't, we had no internet, and we had our diet was, I think it was only 1200 calories a day. We had no sleep to get up at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, get ready and go on the helicopter and live up in the mountain. We had one porta potty for the entire film, which got replaced once a week. It was pretty rudimentary, and I lived through that, and it was 30 below, you know, so there was a lot of aspects of that, you know, can't, you know, this just staying indoors is not as bad as we think. But I do know just the psychological implications from Alive did change my life and changed everybody else's life. You know, the idea that I wore something for 4 months, we were encouraged not to take a shower, you know, things like that. So they're all kind of doing, you know, that I'm thinking about those a lot. The main thing is people are actually stronger than they think. You know, that's one of the things you find out.
That's unbelievable. All right, this is a fun question. Working with Terry Zwigoff, this is from PB at BEA Jedi, at B Jedi, clearly a big Ghost World fan. What was it like working with Terry Zwigoff, and how did you approach Roberta?
Well, Terry and I are close friends. I love Terry. I love the movie Crumb. And I got the part, you know, they offered it to me. We spoke on the phone first, and I read the script. And in the script, the art teacher was described as, you know, having long hair, long braid, and Birkenstocks, and the sweater, and the whole thing. And when I read it, I said, oh my God, I actually had an art teacher just like this, you know, with the gray hair and the long braid and the, you know, very. And I said to Terry, I said, there's only one thing. I want to do the movie. I said, but there's only one thing. I said, I moved to New York in the 80s. And this was the year of Laurie Anderson. And I went to see, there was a girl in my class, and she was actually a performance artist, you know, and put like lunch meat on her body and all sorts of great, you know, crazy things. And I thought, what if this person was more like a failed performance artist? Because to me, being a failed performance artist is worse than even being like a failed actor or a comedian. You know, like, really? You couldn't make it as a performance artist? So we talked about that idea. And here we go, what I was talking about before with the looks. I said, I just think she should have a different, I said, I want to look like Laurie Anderson. And he said, well, you know, can you send me some pictures? So I went to a wig store. I got the famous red wig that I wear in the movie. And I went and I said, I'd like to wear, I said, I was very influenced by Mummenshanz, you know, the people who wore the unitards and, you know, were on the Ed Sullivan Show. Mm-hmm. Now they've had a resurgence, Mummenshanz. Look it up. But I wanted to bring all those elements in. And he, bless his heart, this was the furthest anybody ever let me take a character. Like, to the point that it was actually insane. And I said, don't you think she needs a movie? Like, her movie? I said, it's like, she has to even show, she forces this movie on everybody that she meets, you know? So we really got into this idea of talking about the movie and what the movie, and I actually wanted to be in the movie too. They ended up just doing the thing with the dolls. And I was this close. I mean, they actually had a movie to film with Scarlett Johansson and Thora Birch and Steve Buscemi, but I was like, no, Roberta, we need to film it. But anyway, I totally got into it, and he picked all these great kids, and he let me do a lot of improv, you know, with the kids. Again, like, going up there, they had no idea what I was going to say, you know, like, looking at their pictures. Like, that was one of the great sort of improv lines with the, I thought it was funny because they had the picture of the guy stabbing his, and was asking him what it is, and I said, oh, because I thought it was your father, you know. So there he was, just, and Terry would laugh off camera and ruin most of my takes. But the kids were amazing. Thora was amazing. Scarlett was amazing. Brad Renfro was no longer with us. I didn't have any scenes with him. But he just was terrific to work with. And then
I thought it was fun to see him work with kids too. You know, he was working with all different age actors. That takes a special director to be able to do that.
Well, he's so curmudgeon-y, but he has a great eye for what is truthful, you know? And what's interesting about Ghost World is that I think that part of the reason it sort of caught on more with the younger generation than when it was actually made. Mm. You know, I always find that to be so interesting.
Is that what's Scarlett like on that set? Sorry to interrupt. I'm just curious.
Oh, she was great. I mean, you know, she was very young then. This was one of her early films. I think she had just done the Coen Brothers movie. And I believe her mom was on the set. But yeah, it was very familial. You know, we would all hang out. And like I said, Terry, nothing was too far for Terry. And that's what I love about that character. It's too bad, you know, they did a sequel to it called Art School Confidential. And again, they said I was going to be in it, and then that didn't end up happening. And it didn't quite work, because it was sort of like they were doing, it was like they were playing it straight.
Yeah.
And it's a fine line between playing someone who's, you know, completely nutty, but doing it very truthfully.
Mm.
So it's a favorite experience of mine. And like I said, I love Terry, and we talk quite a lot.
So this is a good question. This comes from Rye Lasu at dailyherald.com. He says, I loved you in the show Action. The first few episodes were brilliant, but then it kind of spun off into an odd direction and it felt like the ending was rushed. I love you in it though. What happened with that show?
Well, that's a whole podcast needs to be done about Action, which I would love for that to happen. There's so many behind the scenes things that happened at the, when we were doing the show, how I got involved in the show, the showrunner, Chris Thompson, the atmosphere on the set, which was kind of no holds barred. And, you know, this just was an era where they were doing the show. I mean, they were basically making Entourage before Entourage, you know, mocking things that were really happening in Hollywood, but doing them for laughs. But it was kind of like a fine line for me to be playing a character, you know, and I've told the story many times before. There was a particular thing. It just started getting like, cool, why don't we do this shocking thing? And why don't we do this shocking thing? And when I mentioned, to Chris Thompson, there was, you know, we read the script and there was something really, really sexual. And I said, you understand that I'm playing a prostitute and I'm not a prostitute, right? And so for saying that, they took me out of the show. He got very upset with me. And so then the next time when I got the script and, you know, they gave me one line in the script, he came up to me and said, what do you think of the script this week? And I said, I love it. It's terrific. And it was a big learning lesson of absolute terror, you know, of, yeah, you're not working with Martin Scorsese anymore, are you? You know, it represents a time in my life where there was no creative license. You know, I love Jay Moore and Ted Demme, who did the original pilot. All the original promise of the pilot was just kind of went downhill because of the atmosphere of what was going on behind the scenes, which was a lot of drug taking, just a lot of really, really crazy pre-Me Too, if that's the umbrella, behavior that is, would almost seem kind of unbelievable now. And I just was coping with it in the best way I knew how, you know. But I definitely found it to be challenging.
You know, yeah, I guess that is sort of a benchmark. That show is sort of a benchmark of is that your first foray into television too, Action?
It was actually not my first foray. I had done, my first show that I did, I was a show called The Single Guy for NBC. Mm-hmm. And then I did Seinfeld, and then I did Gary Shandling.
Oh, that's right, of course.
That was the, you know, so again, and then Gary Shandling, you have something that was, just this incredible life-changing experience for me.
Yeah.
Working with Judd Apatow, Gary, so creative, you know, again, total, you know, improv. I worked with Gary, you know, you go talk with Gary for hours. Tell me everything funny that ever happened to you. And they'd craft it into the script. So again, this was the promise of action. I knew Jay Moore, I'd worked with Jay before. Tremendous respect for Buddy Hackett. Ted Demme, love Ted Demme. So there was tremendous promise in what the show is gonna be. And it became something, you know, terribly, terribly different. And it's too bad.
I was gonna say, do you think because the show was satirizing the seedy underbelly of Hollywood, it kind of unintentionally gave permission for the other above the line people to behave that way themselves?
Well, again, this is, you know, it's gonna be like, I would say that it's like Rashomon, where everyone is gonna have their own opinion.
Right.
But in my opinion, because Chris Thompson is dead, you know, he died from doing drugs. My feeling is he was at the helm of the show. And because of his attitude and because of some of the writers that he hired, the show degenerated into, you know, again, people having casting calls for actresses to come in and writing phony scenes that never happened, for people to be topless in a scene and thinking it's funny. And this was, but you know, and I'm not singling anybody out. This was in the mid 90s. This was called, you know, what it was for me looking at this in 2020, it was being an actress in the 90s was very much like this. So I went from a very artistic kind of bubble to going to Hollywood and thinking, wow, things are pretty different here, you know? And it seemed to be the 98 and 99, this was the apex of bad behavior, it's funny. And if you said anything about it, you were kind of a prig or a prude or uptight. You know, all those kind of things. And so that's, you know, that was my experience. And again, some things are so hot potato, I can't even talk about them because right. it would be like a Ronan Farrow investigation. You know, you'd be like, wait a minute. We were doing this for laughs, you know. It's very interesting, and so I have very mixed feelings about the show. It was one of my favorite characters, and the pilot was one of the greatest experiences I ever had. And I love Jay Moore, and I thought we had incredible chemistry. And I really, really was looking forward, you know, to what we were gonna do. But it turned into, you know, having Steve Garvey on the show and me having to improv jokes with him, you know, about having sex with him in three ways with him and Mookie Wilson. Like, you know, it was a little surreal. It was a little surreal. And I would always think, like, I'm working with Steve Garvey. And now we're doing, you know, that was sort of the joke of every episode of my being a prostitute, you know. So
Nancy Skaggs says, I adored your performance in Grace of My Heart. What is your favorite memory of portraying Denise Waverly? And I'd love to talk a bit about Alison Anders, because at least from my platform, I'm hoping that experience was pretty different than a show like Action. We have about 5 minutes. This will be our last question.
Oh, okay. God, because I see these. There's so many good ones. Stir of Echoes. I'll do a little bit on Stir of Echoes, too. But yeah, Grace of My Heart was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. Just a complete labor of love. I write about it in my book. I blame Dennis Hopper. Allison wrote, you know, the script for me. We cast all the people that we love, Eric Stoltz, John Turturro, Matt Dillon. I just gave 180% to the film every single day. I guess, you know, my favorite day on the set was probably doing the singing scene, although ultimately, you know, they didn't let me do the song, so I was kind of disappointed about that. But I wanted to do something really daring, and in that sense, Allison was very collaborative with me. We came to the scene, which is where, and in my mind, I wanted it to be an audition, because auditioning is so stressful. And I wanted to, by the end of the song, for me and Matt Dillon to be in love. And so I wanted to portray, to start out the song with like this incredible nervous energy and fear, and almost like I'm going to start crying and I'm going to fall apart. And that through the process of singing the song, I gain this confidence, a kind of an anger and a rage. Like I go through, if you look at the scene, I go through every single emotion with Matt Dillon. It's like a love scene. And I think I could have only done that with Matt because we had this kind of brother-sister relationship from To Die For. And I think he was surprised by it, because I've very much always been a person like, well, she's kind of funny and lighthearted and doesn't really have any deep angst. And then all of a sudden it was like, whoa, you know, I wanted to just throw a lot of emotion at him. And by the end of the song, it's like they're in love. And they're almost going to like start kissing by the end of the song. And that was the feeling in the room. And I felt in terms of my acting that I achieved something I wanted to do, which is what I was trained in, Meisner technique, moment to moment, you know, moment to moment acting. And to sustain 7 minutes without speaking, of just going through those emotions, is probably my favorite scene in the movie.
Is this the thing you're most proud of in your career, do you think, that scene?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Just Allison gave me, you know, this ability to do all the things that I was really good at. I could be funny in some scenes. I could be ironic. You know, all the different, you know, just the intellectual part of me of being a songwriter,
right.
You know, this decision of, well, are you a singer or are you a songwriter? You know, and me, Ileana, are you an actress or are you a writer? It's like, well, I'm both, you know, can't you be both? And so there were some elements of my mother, her mother, you know, it was just a great experience. And we keep pushing. Criterion just did, released a couple of Allison's other movies. And if the fans keep bugging Criterion and I keep bugging Criterion, hopefully they will do a re-release of, you know, of that film. Very quickly, just Stir of Echoes.
Yeah.
Again, I go into every movie, half of me is like, I'm really excited I'm going to be in the movie. The other part is, I'm really excited I get to work with Kevin Bacon again. And Kevin and I worked a little bit together in this movie called Picture Perfect. He's just one of my all-time favorite actors. I think he's so underrated. He's been so, so great in so many movies. And I have such tremendous respect for him. And Stir of Echoes was a movie, we're in Chicago. So again, I go to the set every day, you know, whether required to or not. So I remember going to the set and they were shooting ER. So George Clooney would come by our set. And there's a fantastic picture. We're all sitting in chairs. It's like me, Kevin Bacon, David Kapp, the writer, George Clooney. And we made this kind of pose because I whispered to David Kapp, I was like, basically, this is the reason I got into movies. Like, I'd be sitting. So there, I said, will you make sure to take our picture? Because this is like my dream. Like, you're on a set, and George Clooney comes by from another set and hangs out, and you guys all sit around and tell showbiz stories.
Can I tell you something, Ileana?
What?
This is the reason I got into podcasting, so I can relate.
But I love Stuart Echoes. The writer, you know, I think it's Richard Matheson. He did The Incredible Shrinking Man. When I got to meet him when the movie was over, and the best, I mean, I think David Koepp is just a fantastic writer and director. I loved working with him. And I know somebody was asking, because the part was originally a man, and then they made it a woman. And there was actually another actress who was supposed to do the part. And I went in and auditioned for it, and I knocked her out. So always go to the audition, because you never know what's going to happen. I came in and David Koepp said, you know, we actually already have this actress in mind, but if you want to audition. And I said, I am this part. Like, if you put me in the movie, it will enhance this part. And in the end, I got the part. And the only big contribution I had was that I did suggest to David that we go get hypnotized. And we did that, and it changed the whole movie. And I subsequently, the guy who hypnotized us, who was in Chicago, he told me I was highly hypnotizable. I was like, duh, I could have told you that. I went back a couple times and it was incredible. I love getting hypnotized. But I thought that imparted a lot into my character and making it believable, you know. The part that was unbelievable was me smoking pot, because I'm actually not a pot smoker, which I found funny. Everybody was so surprised that I wasn't a pothead.
I think you portray so many quirky free spirits that we all assume it, but Ileana, this was so great. I think we should do this next week again. I mean, we have all these amazing questions. What else are we doing right now? So,
I love answering the questions.
Yeah.
And if I didn't get to the ones here, oh my God, somebody asked me about Bella Mafia.
Next week.
All right. I'm. Thanks, everyone. I've had a blast. If there's anything you want to see in the house, I have set designed totally. Well, not too much.
That's what we'll do. So next week is the house tour and the rest of the questions. Ileana, life is like a movie with
a beginning, a middle, and an end. And we'll see you next week. This has actually been really fun. I needed this.
Me too.
Okay.
All right. See you next week.
Bye, kids.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.